How did it feel once the money hit your account?
It felt absolutely amazing for about 2 months. Then in the third month, I started thinking, okay, now what? Then by the fourth month, I was thinking, I'm really bored and I don't know what to do.
Did you have this big pressure on you, like, I've got all this money now, I have to make sure that I don't mess this up?
Yeah, definitely. There was a case of making sure that I use the money correctly.
How do you survive Amazon?
The best way to say surviving Amazon, I would say...
Welcome to Surviving Amazon, the podcast that exposes the brutal truth behind selling on Amazon, where only the strongest survive. We bring you insider stories and strategies from experts and sellers who've been through it all, the ups, the downs, and the moments that made them question if it was even all worth it. I'm Johnny Bradley, and today we're joined by Neelan Mayani. He has battled through the war ground that is selling on Amazon. He scaled his brand to over seven figures and even exited for cold hard cash. He's lived it, he's survived it, and he's here to share exactly how he did it. So my first question is, how do you survive Amazon?
The best way to say surviving Amazon, I would say, comes down to finding a product that people actually want, right? Mm. So often I see people trying to force the market to buy a product that it doesn't actually want. That is really, really hard. I'd say the first step in surviving Amazon comes to finding a product that actually sells, right? Be it on private label, be it wholesale, whatever it is, make sure there's actually demand for the product and people actually want it rather than trying to force the market to sell something that, or buy something, sorry, that they don't want. I'd say that's the first step.
Because sometimes people can get caught up in the weeds of the process, right? Of, you know, I just want to make, I'll do my marketing in this way and it'll really stand out and I'll do this in this way and it's got this many reviews. But ultimately, like, everything hinges on the product, right? If your product is faulty, if it comes up with loads of negative reviews, that's gonna, you can have the best marketing in the world, you can have the best PPC in the world, you can have the best influencer strategies, but like, if the product's not right, then...
Exactly that. All of those things are completely pointless if they all lead you down the funnel to a shit product that no one wants. And that is the main crux of a lot of people's problems, is that it all comes down to not having a product that people actually want, not a very good product.
So let's just assume people do have a good product, right?
Yeah.
And they go, right, the product's good. It does what it needs to do. Customers like it, etc. There's then a difference between running or launching a product, right? Launching a product on Amazon or brand or Amazon, and then running it successfully. I feel they're two very different like disciplines. So what do you see from your perspective? Because you've been able to build a brand to seven figures, which is a big accomplishment in itself. The things that get you to the first 10K and the first 100K in sales are very different than get you to the first seven figures. So what is it, or is there something that you attribute to the more long-term success?
Definitely. I would say, when it comes to the long-term success, it really comes down to testing as many products as you possibly can, right? Okay. So do your product research, do everything you can to come up with some good ideas. But at the end of the day, you want to aggressively test as many of those ideas as possible. And make sure they're fair tests as well. So don't try and sell a good product with shit pictures and bad titles and bad descriptions and all of that. Make sure when you're selling any product, when you're trying to actually test it out on the market, make sure, you know, the product images look good, the title and descriptions have, you know, all the right SEO in them. Make sure you've got a few reviews on there. And of course, you know, finally PPC comes in at the end.
Yeah, absolutely. So talk us through, for the people that don't know you, what would be really good is to find out just a bit more about your journey and, you know, what's it like to sell a seven-figure brand? And what's it like to build a seven-figure brand?
That's a good question, actually. To be honest, I'm always honest with people in the beginning, is that the reason I got there was because I started out in a really shit job. One thing that I find makes it really hard for most people to get going and really scale on Amazon is they're not running away from enough pain. So if you've got a good or goodish job or even a decent job, you're not really running away from it when you're starting your Amazon seller account. It's not like this has to work or like my life is fucked, right? So big push for me, it has to be because I had such a bad job. It was like my back was against the wall. So I dropped out of uni after a few months because of mental health issues. And I tried a few different things. None of those worked out. And I ended up working for minimum wage in a warehouse, which I'm not sure of how many of you have ever worked in a warehouse, but it's really not fun. And I'm not sure if this warehouse was worse than others, but it was terrible. You know, there were rats running around everywhere. It smelled of piss all the time. Like, not the kind of place you want to work. I was looking for any kind of business or system that would allow me to escape that situation, right? So at the time, every decision that I'd made had sort of led me down this spiral all the way to the bottom. So I thought, why can decisions not lead me all the way back upwards, right? Mm-hmm. So I was looking for a business, and I came across online sales, e-commerce, actually an article by Startup Bros, Will Mitchell, about how you can buy stuff in China, import it to the UK, and then sell it on Amazon and eBay cheap. And that is literally where I started, with really generic crap products, iPhone charging cables, phone cases, what else, HDMI cables, camera accessories, like the shittest stuff. And I wasn't really good at it to begin with. It didn't go very well, but I just kept persisting. You know, as I said at the beginning, it all comes down to finding that right product. So I kept searching around, looking for that right product. And eventually in 2018, I found a good product which would work for me. And that ended up being a motion sensor security light that looked a little bit like a camera. And that was really the main winning product for me. That changed everything. And that was doing, I think it was about 7 to 10K sales or so a month. That was before I'd optimized it and learned how to use PPC properly and everything. But slowly, slowly, I started making that more and more profitable. And so what I did was take that one product, which was a motion sensor security light that looked like a camera, and just took those bare essential facts and looked for other products which were also motion sensor security lights that looked like cameras, and just kept reinventing that exact same design over and over and over again in ways that just looked a bit different. And it just worked better and better and better. And in doing that, I tested out a few other different, you know, design formulas that I thought could work. Many of them didn't. And so I would test them out in really low volume, like 10 or 20 samples. Don't get me wrong, when you're selling those 10 or 20 samples, you're not going to make money. That's not the point of those samples. The point of those 10 or 20 samples is for proof of concept. When you have proof of concept, then you have a reason to go back and buy 100 or whatever. Right, but if you can't sell 10, you can't sell 20, you can't sell 100. So don't buy anymore. Just chuck them out. Forget they ever existed. Right. However, there will be some that sell really well. So what you do is forget about everything that didn't sell and just focus on what did. Reinvest your cash flow back into what sells, and that's exactly what I did. Right. So I tested out loads of different things aside from motion sensor security lights that look like cameras. A lot of them didn't work out. A lot of them did. You know, a few night lights, a few weird things called access panels, tile cutting accessories. None of it really followed a proper theme, but they all worked out. So every single time I found a winner, I just reiterate it in loads of different variations and just keep launching more and more and more. And so that is really what took me from the low level five figures to the high level five figures and six figures and onwards. That is really building a really nice big product base that you're selling for profit in the UK. Now, a really nice, easy hack in properly scaling that is then to start selling in France, Italy, Germany, Spain, and Poland, right? Amazon quite often does offer like an auto translation service for each of those. But what I actually did in all of those circumstances is I went onto that marketplace, made that listing, and despite Amazon's auto translation stuff, I actually went and used Google Translate and translated everything term for term, and also looked at other similar listings doing well in each and every single one of those regions. Looked at their titles and descriptions, translated them back into English to sort of, you know, jiggle them around. And each marketplace only took a day to optimize, right? So don't just trust Amazon's auto translation for each of those regions. Go back into each of them and edit all of them to optimize them all. And that really helped essentially take, you know, X and turn it into 5X within like a space of a few months. That helps a lot. And not only is that really good for scaling your business, but also it makes your business more attractive to aggregators and people who are looking to buy a business, right? Because it's a more round and complete business. It's not something that's just, you know, doing business in the UK. It's doing essentially the whole of the EU. Had I owned Proxenova for longer, I would have expanded out into the US for sure. But yeah, essentially that made it really attractive to aggregators. So yeah, definitely expand as much as you can into the UK, then out into the EU, and keep adding on products in between.
So a couple of things you said there, which were really interesting. I think this is something that existing sellers can take on board. Like quite often you have a successful product and people might try and launch other products which are unrelated to that one product, right? Yep. Rather than going deeper into that into that niche and going, cool, well, we're making money here. What other products in the exact same niche can we do whereby we're getting a slightly different demographic of a customer and taking more market share? It's like, you see people do this with like products on the shelf. So they call it versioning, right? So if you have Nurofen for migraine relief, Nurofen for back pain, Nurofen for whatever, it's the same thing inside or very similar products, pain relief, yep. But it's targeted towards a slightly different customer.
Exactly.
And that's a really nice way where you can, I guess the thing that you've done is you're probably working with similar suppliers. You know the product already and what works and what doesn't work. You know the marketing on how to sell the product. You know the advertising. Like, you really know all of this stuff that initially is a risk. And then you're just going, right, let's just get another product. Question I did have about when you're doing these testings. If you're doing 20, 50 units or so, are you just having them like generic product and like with a throwaway ace in, or are you doing it like a branded product?
So I do it as a branded product. So of course, you know, once you've already got a couple of ASINs already in your inventory with your brand name on it, right? You've already had to get the trademark. You've already had to get brand registry. You've already had to get your GTIN exemption probably, right? If you're not using a GTIN. So now when you're testing out your other products, you may as well just put it under your brand name, because then you can, you know, use A+ content design on that page. You can run ads on it and, you know, you're essentially giving it a fair test.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, because this is something that we do, but we do it a slightly different way, where more recently we're looking at buying generic products, no brand, putting them on Amazon as generic, right?
Yeah.
Still making it look branded without making it like not
giving
actually
it
what it is, right? But we may have the brand existing already. We test the PPC, we test the marketing. And so if we can make it work with no reviews, right, with no actual brand, with like generic product, then we know the PPC, and say we've done 100 units or something like that. If we can make it kind of work, we're like, right, we can now put the time into having this properly branded. We do a private label order, we do the packaging properly, and then we bring it into the brand. So it's kind of like a similar way of doing it, but maybe yours, you're giving it more of a fair test.
Yeah. Yeah.
To actually say, well, I know as many of the variables as possible, I've kind of eliminated, which is really cool. It's a really good way of doing it, especially if you've got those relationships where your supplier knows that you're ordering. Did you do it with the same suppliers, or did you go to different people?
Yeah,
or what?
Exactly that. So actually, my first product was from one supplier. Then I found a second interesting product from another supplier. And when I was buying enough units of that, I just got my first supplier to make that same product, because they were doing a better job and they were cheaper. And then as I found other products, once I decided they were winners, I would then pay my current supplier to then start producing them. Now, quite often when you ask them to change a design or make a custom design for you, they're going to ask you to pay for the mold, which is normally between $3,000 and $5,000, depending on the complexity. And if you know you're onto a winner, then you may as well pay it. Because a few orders from that supplier, even if it's just like a fraction cheaper, within a few orders of a few thousand units, you've already made all of that money back anyway. So yeah, not only the same supplier, but also the same listing, right? In terms of most of the information that I used to build my first listing, I'd copy and paste it into the next listing and change a couple words here or there. So instead of indoor, outdoors, outdoor, or instead of indoor, outdoors, indoor. Same thing with A+ content. Again, you'd use more or less the same stuff, change a few photos, change a few things here and there, and even PPC. So literally, I found the winning formula for this first product in terms of PPC. So I cloned that exact campaign and just ran that same campaign separately for the next product and the next and the next and the next. That brings me to another thing, by the way. When you're scaling products that are really, really similar to each other, be sure to use separate PPC campaigns. A lot of people just shove them all into one campaign, and that data is very hard to read when it's all in one campaign, because one word might be really effective for this ASIN, but really ineffective for this ASIN.
Yep.
So, you know, have you got a good ACOS or a bad ACOS? Because they're both mixed together now.
Well, exactly. Which is really obviously annoying. Amazon, if you have like products in the ad set, Amazon can go, well, this one's getting the exposure and the sales, let's push the spend to that one, and this one gets no exposure, and it could be getting exposure, but it's being like strangled by Amazon, by their algorithm.
Exactly that.
Separate them into portfolios and keep it separate.
Yeah.
I would say, did you find that then, because if you're saying, hey, this one's for outdoor and indoor, this one's for indoor only, because The great thing about that is that the customer intent, if they're searching on Amazon for indoor one, they're more likely to buy the indoor one rather than the outdoor and indoor one, I would assume.
Correct.
So one of your, I guess, your methods for doing this is like, well, what are the things that people are searching for? And what products can we then create that meet those customers' needs? Was that like what you were thinking when you were coming up with these versions?
Yeah, it was. Somewhat, but more along the lines of just reinventing the exact same thing, but making a bit different. Giving indoor options, outdoor options, solar options, battery options. But again, when you have a lot of related products, one thing that is always really good to do, is something that you can see on Amazon's listing for Proxnova products still anyway. If any of you want to search it up, Proxnova, it's spelled the same way. Check it out on Amazon. At the bottom of each ASIN page, there's a table which shows the first, second, third, fourth, and they're all compared along in a table. So if you end up clicking on an ASIN that you didn't necessarily really want, or it sort of wanted it, but you didn't want it, as you scroll through that page, you're quite likely to see the product that you would prefer. And I noticed that table made a massive difference across all the ASINs. So just copy that exact same table across all the ASINs. So there's like a comparison chart. So you're always being funneled from one to the other.
Nice. Okay. Yeah. And that's good. And other ways people can do that is not only like that, it's your display advertising. It's in your brand story, because if you've got a few, you know, products, you can talk about that. But ultimately, I think what you're saying is, if you're getting a customer if you're getting a session, right? If you're getting someone to your page, keep them buying your product and not going to someone else's, because it's very easy for them to go, boop, off we go on to someone else's product. It's like quite hard to actually keep them on brand. But the more options you have, I think you're right in saying that not every customer wants the exact same thing. And they might go, actually, I do want this one that's got a slightly different look to it, or this one's battery operated because I can't be asked to, you know, power this or whatever it's going to be, or I need a solar one. Maybe my where I want to put it is going to be in the shade all the time and it's never going to get the sunlight. And I think that's a really good way to think about building your brand, so that you're not just doing loads of crazy products. You're thinking, what do customers actually want? How can I make small changes? Keep the logistics very similar. Like, you know, everything can be shipped together, which is a great way to save on fees or costs. And, you know, do what you know, rather than always going into something that's an unknown, basically. Would you say that that's responsible for your growth and for the success?
Definitely, yeah. Just reinventing what already works. So once you've found a winning product, reverse engineer it to find its winning formula, then take that winning formula and just reiterate it over and over and over again. And as you do that, of course, you can explore other potential winning formulas. There's nothing from stopping you using your winning formula currently and testing out other formulas that you think could work too alongside it.
Fair enough. So you start the brand, you do all this cool stuff with scaling it. And how did the sale come about? Did you get approached, or did you approach someone?
So it was actually good timing, in terms of I was at a point where I'd been approached by a brokerage firm called eVenturing, actually, sorry. So I was approached by a brokerage firm called eVenturing on my emails. And I saw the email, but I didn't think too much of it. I was like, okay, yeah, that's interesting. And then over the coming months, as the brand kept growing and growing and growing, it was just becoming increasingly difficult for me to manage every single moving part on my own. An Amazon store isn't too difficult to run, but if you take that store and times it by 100, no matter how easy it is, it's going to be hard simply just because of the volume, right? Just in terms of, for me, the time and labor taken in bringing in, let's say, sometimes 8 to 12 pallets to my home, processing them all, storing them, and then sending some out, and then a few weeks later, sending more out and more out. And then, you know, keeping on top of IP, keeping on top of all the little things that you're doing. At a big scale, it was a lot, right? And I was working completely on my own. I had no employees, no VAs, nothing at all. Right. And that was mainly, as I say, because I was working from home, you know, in the confines of your own home, it's a bit difficult to get other people to come in and help you with you know, the physical labor. And I think more than that as well, it was a case of, you know, as it keeps growing, all these little complexities keep growing as well. And COVID made a big, big difference. That not only added to the growth, but it meant it was very difficult, you know, in terms of lockdown restrictions, to actually grow the business in terms of helping you find those right employees who you could trust, carry out the right kind of functions, it was just more and more difficult. So it made a lot of sense. As things just got more and more difficult, I started thinking more and more about that email from eVenturing, like, should I sell it, should I not? And so, you know, I started getting into chats with them and understanding, you know, how's the business valued, and you know, what sort of value would we be able to sell this at, and you know, what makes a difference to the value. And yeah, learning all of that information helped me sort of in the preceding year, 18 months from there, what was it about? Yeah, 18 months or so, to actually sort of optimize the business into the perfect shape in order for it to be sold.
Mm. And when there's two questions about that. First one, because if I said, all right, look, I want to sell my brand, the question comes is, like, how much is it worth? What is someone going to pay for it? And there's always multipliers out there. But when they said the number, what did you think?
So when they said the number, I thought that's a decent number. It's a good number. And it made me think, wait, is it worth more than that? Is it worth less than that? What's the real value? Because even as an entrepreneur, I think it's very, very easy to feel like your business is worth more than it is too, because you've got a personal attachment to it. And that's always the case with every business. Mm-hmm. Every business, I would say most founders feel their business is probably worth twice what it actually is. Mm-hmm. And I was the same, right? I genuinely believe my business is probably worth twice than what it actually is. But the way businesses, particularly private label businesses, are valued, at least from recently, has been when you take your last year's profit, so your EBITDA, so your profit after cost of goods, taxes, PPC, advertising, all those kind of costs that you might incur, shipping, everything. So that actual real profit number, what you do is take that and times
not including things like your own wages or anything like that.
So that is known as SDE. So that is excluding those seller discretionary earnings.
Yes. Yeah.
So if you were to be paying yourself, I don't know, 10 grand a month, that wouldn't be included within, so that wouldn't be removed from the profit of the business. So it wouldn't remove 120 grand profit, but it's essentially looking purely at the Amazon seller account and the churning out of stock versus profit that comes out the other side. What you pay yourself after that is totally up to you. That won't affect the valuation. Before you consider any human beings in it, the amount that you're buying your product for and then selling it minus all the costs, that raw profit data in between, that is the number which is multiplied, right? Mm-hmm. So that number will be multiplied by something between 3 and 4. So typically it gets a lower valuation if the brand has less protection. So for example, let's say you've got trademarks but no design rights on your products. You'll probably command a slightly lower multiple. And also, let's say your brand is being sold around the UK, but not the EU. Again, that's something that will sort of command a slightly lower multiple. The more protected your brand is, so for example, design rights is something that's really, really important in protecting a brand. Having loads of design rights makes a big, big difference. Selling in more than one region, so not just the UK, but the EU, makes a big, big difference. And of course, having IP in more than just one region. So, you know, I had a trademark and design rights for many products in the UK, but then I also went to a lot of trouble filing a trademark and design rights in the EU as well. Mm. At the time, I felt like this is really complicated and this is really difficult. But at the end of it, it was definitely worth it. Yeah. That makes a big difference. And I think you can get a multiple around 4 or even 4.5 if you also are manufacturing the product yourself. Now, of course, I was importing this from China, so someone else is making the product. Whereas I think if you have the entire supply chain from A to Z, where you're actually manufacturing it as well, and you're doing over, I believe, 5 million, you're likely to command an even higher multiple, something like 4, 4.5.
Amazing. So one of the key things here is, and this is what I speak to people about a lot, is like, if you want to sell your business in the future, you want to make it desirable to sell. Right. Yep. And yeah, you might not want to go into like France straight away or into the Netherlands or whatever, but put it into your roadmap. The same with like off Amazon sales. I was speaking with a evaluator like a year ago or so, And he says the same thing, like a year before you want to sell, then, you know, you have a conversation 18 months, maybe before you want to sell, this is what you want the next year to look like. Maybe how can we restructure a few things to make it look more profitable? But also make sure you have all the due diligence sorted so that when someone comes along to buy it, you're like, yep, yeah, here's everything you need. Here's all the certificates. Here's this, here's design rights. Here's the proper like certifications for the product. Because sometimes like people don't have them. They just like have the supplier's certificate, which like isn't theirs. And, and all of these things, like they seem like, oh, I've got to pay a few hundred dollars for that, or I'm paying a few thousand for this and a few thousand there. At the time you might think, oh, is this trademark worth it? Is this extra design right thing worth it? Because no one's come for me. No one's tried to copy me yet. But the answer is like, yes, because if you're spending a few thousand here, but that ends up to be 10, 20, 50 grand extra in your, or even 100 grand extra in your valuation, hey, that's a worthwhile investment, right?
Huge. Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'd say on most of the design rights, I got a return of not just 100, but around 1,000. So whatever I paid or cost to even maintain those design rights and the trademark, I got a return of not 100 times, but 1,000 times.
Wow.
So those admin costs are definitely, definitely worth it.
That's really, really important to know.
I'd go as far as to say that the valuation or the sale of Proxnova all came down to the fact that I was basically selling them all those design rights and the trademark. It was really IP that was being sold. So having that IP in hand is really important. So to reiterate to anyone out there who's looking to really scale and actually sell their business, the main things you need to consider are IP. So make sure you've got a trademark and design right, and not just in the UK, but across Europe. And make sure you're, of course, selling across Europe to be making as much profit as possible. But the second thing is also make sure you've got the right compliance documents. I mean, you touched on this earlier, Johnny. Making sure you've got your CE certificate, UKCA certificate, the test report in the background, because at any moment, Amazon can ask you for those. And if you can't produce it or you can't produce the right document, Amazon will just switch you off like that. It doesn't matter whether you're selling 1,000 units a day, they don't care.
True.
And that can really be devastating. So make sure right from the beginning, you have those compliance documents in hand. And with regards to the design rights, sorry, going backwards, a lot of people might think, oh, what do I need these design rights for? No one's tried to copy me, no one's come after me. That creates a whole monopoly around what you sell. And that is what makes your business more interesting to an aggregator. Why would an aggregator want to buy your brand when they could actually just copy everything you do? Because you've not put any protection around it, right? They could just stop the whole thing again. Anyone could. So by doing that, you've added a significant barrier to entry. So having those design rights makes a massive, massive difference. And there were times where I woke up in the morning many times, went onto Amazon and saw someone had cloned my exact product. So I just went onto Amazon Brand Registry, report a violation, this ASIN violates this design right, click submit. I'd go back to the original ASIN, press F5, page not found. Literally.
Damn, man.
That simple.
You just ruined someone's day.
You did. But I mean, look, they're copying your ASIN in the first place, right?
At the end
of the day, remember, you've gone to a lot of time, effort, energy, and risk in testing that product and creating a marketplace around it. So why would you want anyone else to just come and copy it all?
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree. And on the compliance note, this is something that I think is really important. Like we talk, I've got a podcast with a guy called Rahul Chawla, and he's in a company called Kima. So they do product compliance and testing. And, you know, I ask him like, you know, why should people do this? And he's like, it's a legal requirement, first of all. So one, yes, you have to be worried about Amazon requesting something, but if your products get like tagged at, at the port upon entry by customs, they're going to go, we need this, 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 and this. And if you don't have it, you're screwed. Not only is that shipment screwed, but it opens the door for them to go, oh, let's actually audit what they're doing as a company and let's see what else they're selling, because maybe they don't have the compliance requirements or the legal requirements for those products as well. And from an aggregator point of view or a purchaser's point of view, they don't want, first of all, to have a customer that bought one of your products a year ago come back and sue you because it's broken and smashed a, you know, cut their eye open.
Yeah.
And then you not have the compliance, you not have the tests, you not have the legal requirements, because then it leaves them open to it. And ultimately, it can make your business worthless if you don't if you don't have that. And some sellers I know when they started, they don't do that, and they should, but they didn't because they didn't know, or the supplier's gone, oh yeah, you can use ours, and they basically, it's the equivalent of Tippex out and write in your name. But certainly an existing seller, if that's you and you've done that in the past, get it done properly. Because if you're looking to sell, this sort of stuff is important and they will look into it. Just like if you were to want to get your products into John Lewis or somewhere like that, like they're going to check that you've got this stuff.
Yeah.
And if you don't, they're not going to sell your product.
Yeah. I got super lucky with that, by the way, talking about compliance. So just like you said, a lot of sellers don't know about compliance. I was one of those sellers. I had no clue that I needed compliance. When I became aware I'm going to start needing these compliance documents, I was just lucky that my supplier was really good and had all of that stuff, honestly, in their file. But during the sales process of Proxnova, actually, they flagged 4 ASINs and sent me a message saying, can you send us all of the CE documentation for all of these, CE certificates and documentation and test reports for all of these products. In these, like a long code of numbers showing that it, you know, adheres to ENBS 8003 like dash whatever, right? And I was like, shit. Luckily, I had all of the documents that showed that, and that was just luck. With that, that's the other reason why I felt like it had gotten to a point where I needed an aggregator to come and buy this out, because as you grow more and more, people are going to look into this more and more, and it's just going to get more and more complex, and one person can run out of talent in that. So with compliance, I have to say, and I have to admit, I got a bit lucky, but it's never a mistake I'm ever going to make again. In terms of my future brands, I've always made sure we've got all of the documentation immediately. And it could be a really bad mess.
Well, yeah, precisely. I've had a product recently that's got flagged by customs. And they're literally saying, all right, you need this, 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 and this. And like, fortunately, like we've got that. And it can just be like, bam, here's the email. Here's all the things. Here's all the naming correctly. Here's all the stuff. Here's all the ISO, bloody whatever. And then the products get released. And you're like, oh my God, thank God for that. But at the end of the day, sometimes you never know, like, have we done everything correctly? So I always recommend go to experts for that and go to a compliance company, a testing company. So they... like we use a company where you can literally, here's the product, here's pictures of it, here's where it's sold, who it's for. They'll tell you all of the list of requirements that it needs to sell in your location or if it's in Germany or wherever. So at least you know this is what I need, and they obviously can do the testing for you. But those are the sort of things that it's boring to talk about. It's not sexy or anything like that, but if it makes you more money at the end of the day, if you sell your brand, it's worth it, right? It's definitely worth it.
Thing is, you think you'll never, ever, ever be asked for it. I always thought, like, I mean, I'll never be asked for this. Even if they do ask me for it, I don't know what's right, what's wrong. But it's crazy, but at some point you just will. You just will be asked. And if you don't have an answer for that question, you're fucked.
Yeah, it could all fall through. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, it didn't fall through for you. So how did it, and this is what people really want to know, right? How did it feel once the money hit your account?
It felt absolutely amazing. Honestly, it felt amazing.
Talk me through it.
Less amazing than you think, but still really amazing. So it's one of those things that, imagine you've spent years and years climbing a mountain, and eventually you get to the top, and it's the most beautiful thing you've ever seen. What are you going to do? You're going to stand there for 5 minutes, and you'll be like, okay, now what? Right? And that is honestly what happens. No matter what your journey has been, when you get to that, you're like, okay, now what? So that was a big part of it after a few months. So, you know, when I sold it and the money hit the account, it felt amazing, for about 2 months. Then in the third month, I started thinking, okay, now what? Mm-hmm. Then by the fourth month, I was thinking, I'm really bored and I don't know what to do.
Did you have this big pressure on you? Like, I've got all this money now. Like, I started as a minimum wage job. Don't fuck this up. Like, I've got this pressure of this money. Did you feel like it was burning a hole in your pocket, basically? Like, I have to protect this. I have to make sure that I don't mess this up.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely there was a case of that. Making sure that I use the money correctly. For me, I invested it all into buy-to-let rental property. I also maxed out my pension contributions and ISAs and things like that. Things that I'd always recommend for everyone, especially the pension contribution and ISAs. Because those are both tax-free. Mm-hmm. So that's a really good thing to max out. And of course, as I say, buy-to-let rental properties. So I didn't actually spend any of it, if I'm honest, because in the years preceding, I'd been taking out some crazy salaries from Proxenova anyway. So I'd paid off all my student loans, any debts and things, bought the things that I'd liked at the time in terms of, you know, getting a home and whatnot. So in that sense, it was all sort of ready to invest. But it was also, I guess, the minimum wage mentality that was still like, oh shit, if you're not working, then, you know, you're gonna run out of money and starve to death. Now, at that point, it's not true, but you've constantly got this thing niggling away. And a lot of friends and family asking you, so, oh, no, that's cool. You've sold your business. That's amazing. Congratulations. So so what now? What are you going to do next? And that's the one you're like, I don't know. I don't know. So, yeah, I mean, that's what led me to coaching, mainly because I was building those other brands in the background. And a few close friends and family members asked me, you know, could you show me how I could do this as well? And so I did. And it literally just took about 3 or 4 times of doing it before I found that actually what I was teaching was more or less the same to everyone in terms of it was a proper curriculum. And everyone was doing far better than I expected them to. So I thought, you know what, why not do this as a thing? Mainly that's what coaching is to me in terms of the main bread and butter comes from things like property and online sales. But the coaching means you're actually, you know, having a business where you deal with human beings. After many, many years of working, you might have found this yourself as well, Johnny, that many years, let's say 5, 6 years of working at home on your own with no team or employees. I think now you've probably got teams and employees. But after that amount of time on your own, no one else you're working with, plastic products that you're selling, it gets very, very stale and very lonely, actually. Really depressing. No matter what you're earning from it, it gets super depressing. So that's what led me to actually coaching.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Like, I've spent the last, I don't know, 7, 8 years now basically at home.
Exactly.
Like, I speak to people all day, right? Hundreds of people. I've got a team now. But at the same time, it's on a computer screen. It's on a phone. And there is always that thing of, you know, I'm speaking to people, but sometimes I haven't actually seen anybody in a long time. So I feel I have to get out and go to events and stuff like that. And I think that's always good to go to. But you're right. I think entrepreneurship in general is always quite lonely because not a lot of people get what you're going through. Like, friends, family members, they think, oh, that must be nice. Like, oh, working for yourself, that must be great. Not understanding the stress and the amount of time that you are just by yourself working on something with not anyone to speak to. But also, I guess, when you sold and they go, okay, what do you do now? They have an expectation of you that you're like flying now, you're going to do it again. It's going to be incredible. But sometimes you're like, hey, maybe I want some different things out of life. And, you know, that I find doing the products, the thing that I enjoy most about brands and products is creation. Like, that's the thing that I absolutely love, is creating and like designing and the how are we going to get customers to buy this. The actual like day-to-day running of it is, I could take it or leave it, right? Because it's not very glamorous, right? It's really not. It's, you're dealing with spreadsheets and numbers and logistics and stuff like that. Unfortunately, we've got a COO to do that now. And I don't have to do it. But I think if we didn't have that, then it'd be certainly a different position. And actually, one of the questions I did have is that as you were growing the brand, you said you were doing it all yourself. Was there not ever a point you thought, oh, maybe I should just get someone to do, you know, the advertising or the whatever? Was that a decision because you wanted to just say, well, I could do it myself and I could take more money for myself? Or what really led to that decision of not maybe building a team?
That's actually a really good question. Really good question. I think mainly because COVID meant it grew so quickly in such an uncontrollable fashion that it was very difficult for me to keep things tidy as I grew it. And then it just, at a certain point, just became overwhelming, to a point where, you know, sometimes I'd be like, I don't even know how to resolve some of the problems that come up. And as I say, I just felt like I was running out of talent. So to outsource some of these things, I guess some of them, they definitely could have been outsourced. But at the time, for me specifically as well, you know, having come out of a minimum wage job and sort of fought tooth and nail from the ground up with like zero budget, then blowing my savings over and over again and eventually getting there, I was super exhausted. I was super tired. I was drained mentally, emotionally, physically, everything. And on top of all of that, I could have kept going, but it was more a case of 100% of your financial well-being is tied to this one thing, right? And it's a case of you can get employees and grow it, but still 100% of your risk is all tied into this one thing. And if Amazon one day just pull out that plug, then everything's fucked, right? Not to say people shouldn't build and grow Amazon stores to that size, they should. But never keep it all on Amazon. Make sure you're selling on eBay and your own website too. And make sure to diversify as well. Have other businesses and brands alongside it, even if they're both on Amazon, because it's very unlikely that one will be suspended and the other one will too. Just to spread things out. And at the time, it was all focused on a single failure point. So the risk seemed super high. Not that, if ever it got suspended, I couldn't fix it. I mean, I've never come across something I can't fix, if, in all honesty. Be it a suspended ASIN, suspended account, any kind of problem, I've never found something I can't actually fix yet. But that's not the point. I don't want the first thing that breaks that I can't fix to be my whole financial livelihood either.
And look, it does happen. Like it does happen. I was speaking with a guy called Jordan, and they had 95% of their revenue coming from Amazon, and 70% of their listings were taken down for drugs, of all things, and it was nothing to do with that whatsoever. And they tried to get most of them back. They never did. And they had to look elsewhere. And in this case, it was TikTok, and generated multi-millions on TikTok now, which is cool. But that was like an oh fuck it moment. They had a few months to basically make enough money. Because they had bills to pay, they had a warehouse, they had staff, and that was their sole income. So I do agree. You know, when people say, oh, you should have seven streams of income, and you shouldn't have seven streams of income from day one, but you should certainly think, let's have one, let's build it, try and spread the risk as much as possible. If that's going to be eBay, Facebook or TikTok or whatever, or even other marketplaces. And then you go, right, well, I've done this once. Can I do it again, right? Maybe I'll do a different brand, or I go to a different niche or something like that, so that you can create those systems, you know what works, and then you can do it again. And what I've seen quite a few times is a lot of like the successful sellers is they don't just do it once. They, I was speaking to you just before, I think there was a guy we had 2 years after he started his company, his FBA business, he sold it, and then since has set up like two or three more businesses, more brands, because it's like, well, I do it once, I can just do it again. It's not, as long as it's not in the same
literally the same as finding one winning product. It's the same
Yeah,
as doing the same
exactly.
thing,
Yeah.
but it's on a higher scale. Exactly that.
Precisely. And I think that's really key for people to learn, and also to take some, to look at your experience and go, how can people learn from that? Is I would personally say, like, get some of the donkey work away from you. So customer support, someone can do that. You can have an SOP for that sort of stuff, for returns, blah, blah, blah. All that can be done by someone else. Same with like shipping plans and making changes to listings. An account manager, you can pay an account manager a few hundred dollars a month. They do an hour a day, and then everything's managed. And I think those are some of the things that when sellers can afford to do that as soon as possible to get the donkey. I'm sorry if I call it donkey work and no one gets offended by that, but like if that's what you do.
That's okay. I was fully saddled by
No,
not
like,
the, and I totally agree with you. Totally agree with you.
like the grunt work, right? The grunt work, and we've got people that do that, and they're very good at what they do. It's a task that needs to get completed so that you can work on the business and not in the business. And I think the thing that you went through is that, COVID was so busy and so financially successful for a lot of Amazon sellers, because that was where people purchased products, right? That you must have got like, oh my God, I need to really like put all my focus into this because it's going so well. And you literally probably didn't even have time to think about hiring
Yeah,
people,
literally that. Literally
like,
that. I
or
didn't
to
have
even train them.
that time. Yeah.
And
That was it. If I were to do it again, I would definitely, have VAs, lots of team members to do everything. But yes, but for me at COVID at the time, I sort of went into it just sort of passing the VAT threshold around 100K. And then by the end of the COVID lockdown era, it was doing more than 1 million a year. So I'd done more than 10 times bigger, which was, it was very
hard
difficult
to
to
manage.
manage those moving parts in between.
Yeah, exactly. Just the cash flow for that and maintaining cash flow must have been really, really challenging.
Yeah,
And did
definitely.
you have a system for that? Did you have any like financial products that allowed you to do that, or were you just reinvesting profits?
I was just reinvesting profits, to be honest. And I would regularly just go back through my Amazon seller account. And actually go back through the transaction breakdown. So on your Amazon payments, where you have the disbursements tab, where you click on disbursements, it will show you, you know, what your disbursements are, what's come to you, what's gone out. It's like a Sankey diagram. But then beyond that, you can actually, beyond statement view, you can go to transaction view, where you can see each and every single transaction. So go and click on each and every single order for each and every single kind of product. So not each and every single order, but a different order for each and every single product. Make sure that payout amount is correct. And then also make sure your PPC is correct. Make sure, you know, your tax bills are what they should be. Make sure your unit prices and what you're paying for your stock is what it should be. And in that sense, the profit should flow quite freely. I didn't keep a super close track on what I was doing, mainly because by that point as well, eVenturing had sort of come in and taken over in terms of downloading data and crunching all the numbers for me. That made a huge, huge difference to help me sort of get everything tidy. Having that brokerage firm sort of tidied a lot of things up, made things make a bit more sense as well. But before that, yeah, generally I was not using a any kind of app to track finances.
Wow, well you did incredibly well to do that, because I would have just been like spreadsheets, crazy. I just like load up the like seller board or whatever. So I think that's really good advice. And actually on that, quite a lot of people lose money in, they're paying the wrong FBA fees because they haven't done a cubic scan. Like they're just paying, yeah, maybe it's even 12 pence more than they need to pay. But you times up by thousands, that adds up to money. Or like when Amazon, they damage or they lose products, they don't tell you about that. Yeah. they wait for you to go, hey, what about that product that you lost? Can we have some money for that? You know, only then will they actually give you that money. So a lot of time people can have a lot of money that they should have been given by Amazon, but they just don't. There's services, yep, to do that, like Getida. You can do it yourself. Even Helium 10 have a tool to do that, which is pretty cool because they don't charge commission on it, which is pretty, yep, nice. But those like small details, they can like release profit. Or even, this isn't the same now, but probably when you were doing it, you would have been charged VAT fees from their Luxembourg company for your like FBA, yep, fees and stuff like that. But I remember we got back thousands and thousands from overpaying on VAT fees.
Exactly the same.
Yeah. It was, we were like, wow, free money. Amazing. This is great. But it felt like, you know, we were withdrawing from the bank of Amazon. But those things, like, they do make a difference. And it's, if you can put that into a weekly or monthly checklist, I think those things really do help existing sellers. Just make sure that they're, you know, we're talking about single percentage differences in profit. You know, if you can get that extra percent profit, it's something that you can use to either build your business or, you know, line your pocket. My last question though is really more looking into the future of Amazon. Like, you've seen Amazon change from what it was back in like 2016, 17, 18, which is basically get anything, stick a label on it, and it will make money, to where, yeah, it is now, which is a lot more, you know, brand led. Where do you see Amazon selling going in 2025?
So I see Amazon becoming more and more difficult to sell on for new sellers to get started, right? In terms of the difference between difficulty back in 2016 in getting started selling on Amazon versus now is quite big, right? It's much, much easier back then than it is now. Now it's much more possible, mainly because there are people like ourselves who have done this or do this every day and for many years, who can actually advise you on how to do it. But it's only going to keep getting harder. Now, of course, people like ourselves will all keep developing to make sure that, you know, we always know how to do that. But that labor gap between getting started and actually getting launched is just going to keep. So I think it's going to get harder and harder for individuals and small businesses to get started selling on Amazon, because Amazon is just going to keep raising the barrier of entry constantly over time. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is obviously simple, right? Amazon has millions and millions of people who want to sell on Amazon. And a lot of them will be cowboys and just shit sellers, right? So what Amazon is going to do is put barriers in place that only the creme de la creme, the best sellers, the most resourceful sellers can get over. So that on the Amazon platform, only the best, most resourceful sellers are left. All of the lower quality sellers will have all been wiped out by some barrier early on. So that's where I see Amazon becoming more and more corporate, in terms of they're aiming more at the bigger companies, less at individuals and smaller companies. I'm not saying that they'll ever make it impossible. I think it'll always remain possible for small sellers and individuals, but it'll get increasingly difficult.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that's a good thing or a bad thing for people that are starting?
To be honest, like anything in the world, I think the best things and the worst things about anything are both the same. So it's a good thing and a bad thing. So it's a bad thing in the sense that it will be a lot harder for you to get started, but it's a good thing in because it's so hard to get started, it will filter out 99% of your competition too.
Yeah, I think that's the key. I definitely like echo that thought where the harder it is, and we've seen this over the years, and like the sentiment that I've seen amongst sellers over the last year to 18 months is the harder the product, the better it is, right?
Yeah.
If there's, it's dangerous and it's restricted and it's whatever, like those are the products that people want to do because the barrier to entry is getting higher and higher and higher, and Amazon are actually checking this stuff as well. They're not just going, oh yeah, cool, you're safe, oh fine, you just come on in, we'll trust you. They don't do that anymore. They're like, yeah, prove to us that you've got this. And I think it is good if you take this seriously. Back in like, we're talking what, 7, 8, 9 years ago, it was more of a like a make money online thing, right?
Yeah,
it was much more like anyone could do this and make money fast, or like at least very quickly, because it was, like you said, a lot easier. A lot of products you didn't need to put a lot of effort into, and they would still make, you could do a launch and you could be on the first page in like 3 days. And
in the day, you didn't need brand registry or GTIN exemptions or anything. You would just literally put in your brand name and write a random, I used to write a random number. Just had to be 12 digits long for the barcode. That worked for a long fucking time.
Wow.
But yeah, eventually they actually asked for real barcodes. But back in the day, it was so easy, so easy.
And I think if we were to have the same conversation in 5 years' time, we would look back now and say it was so easy, right?
Yeah.
Because I spoke with, who did I speak? I think it was Danny McMillan I spoke with the other day, who's the host of Seller Sessions. And I think he said, yeah, it's harder, but the tools and resources that we've got are also significantly better. Like the data that we've got from brand analytics, we didn't have in 2017. Like it didn't exist.
Yeah. When we started, you know, Jungle Scout and Helium 10 and shit like that just didn't exist. There were no seller tools. There wasn't even like Amazon sellers weren't a thing. People who sold on Amazon were a myth.
Yeah, it didn't. Yeah, it wasn't a thing. And it's really only in the last few years, especially with the rise of AI and GPTs, it's getting so much better to, like you talked about translating, right? If I want to get something translated, I have to, you know, either hire a translator, I have to use a service for it. I can use Google, but who knows, you know, if it's going to be right. But now GPTs are very good at translations.
Yeah,
they're so good. And that's like free. It's, you know, it's free to do that. We've been doing this recently where we're using GPTs and things like Midjourney to concept product ideas and to come up with logos and demographics and take all of the listing copy from all of the other sellers and it analyze for us. Like that didn't exist even a year ago. And this is why I'm thinking that yes, it's harder to sell, but because we've got all of these tools, if you are resourceful, like you said, and you treat them, then I think it's just as good opportunity as it was back in 2017. Because all those people that want that quick money, they're not going to put the time in and they're not going to be able to jump those hoops and even want to, because it's more difficult. So it's interesting to see where it's going to go. And what's your plans?
So my plans are definitely to keep selling on Amazon and eBay for the rest of my life, actually. I definitely want to be selling for a long time. I love doing it. In fact, it's less about money, more like a game to me now. It's just, you know, can you put something up and actually make people buy it, right? Can you put something up and make people actually want it? It's as I say, it's just become like a game. And the money made from it is just like points that you're collecting. And I feel like actually that is a really good way, by the way, for Amazon sellers to look at it as well. I realized that I became so much more successful on Amazon when I stopped thinking about it as, you know, products that I want people to buy. And, you know, I started just thinking about this game and business in general as a game. So just to keep playing the game of selling stuff online.
Amazing. I think that's great advice, because at the end of the day, you know this, right? Money in a bank account, it ends up just being figures at a point. And it's like, okay, well, if I can use some of these numbers and I can make more of those numbers, then it is less about the, it feels like not real, right? It's just numbers. And yeah, I think it then does become a game of, you get an idea, you think, okay, I've seen this opportunity, I'm going to do it because, like, I think I can stand out. I think I can market this. Let's see if I can do it and see what works. If it doesn't, fair enough. If it does, amazing. And I think it opens up your opportunity or opens up your mind to what's possible for selling online when you realize that the stuff sold on Amazon, the majority of it, you know, 60% of it or whatever it is just sold by normal people, like just absolutely normal people. And I think the big thing at the moment is obviously TikTok. If you look at TikTok, it's such an easy win for Amazon sellers to just literally duplicate their listing, put it on TikTok and start selling it. It's like, it's where Amazon was in 2015, 2014. Such a massive opportunity. And I think once you realize, hey, I can do this, this is actually not as hard as it really, people do think it is. And it is a game that I can win or I can at least play. You end up having some really good results.
Yeah, honestly, that really is it. It's like any game that you might play on your PlayStation or Xbox. If you've got time to do that, you know, the first time you play it, you're going to die. Second time, you're going to die. Third time, up to the 10th time, you're going to die. But afterwards, when you keep playing it, you keep playing it, eventually you'll get good at it.
Yeah.
And that's how I got good at selling online. I'm sure, Johnny, that's how you got good at selling online, right? You just keep doing it until it becomes a point where you've done it for so long that it'd be unreasonable for you not to be good at it. That's all.
Absolutely. Yeah. Look, thank you again for helping us survive Amazon. Now, guys, if you liked this episode and you found it helpful, please do share it with other sellers, subscribe, comment if you're watching it on YouTube or whatever, so we can help other sellers survive on Amazon. Dude, thank you again so much for your time. I really Thanks, appreciate man. It.
All right. Thank you so much. See you guys in the jungle.
Bye, everyone. Bye-bye.